MacCast, Monday, October 17th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam. This is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. What a crazy week last week was. Oh, man. Between the last couple weeks, kind of. Between iOS 5 and the new iPhone 4S and all the other things, iCloud, everything that Apple brought out, I think they put a lot of pressure on us and themselves, as you're going to hear in this episode. Things didn't go quite as smoothly, I think, as Apple probably wanted. In the end, I think it all worked out, but it was a little rough on the launches over the last couple weeks. But there might be a very good reason for that. Demand was incredible, as you're going to hear in this episode. We have just a ton of stuff to get into, and don't have a lot of feedback from you. I'm going to be giving you a lot of my thoughts and impressions and opinions on all this stuff, and then I will look for you to give me some feedback in upcoming episodes on what you think of all this stuff. But we do have one question from a listener, so we'll get to that and more in this episode. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. I've been telling you about Notebook on the MacCast for a while. One thing that I think we've done in the past that I thought would be good to do is I just dive into a feature that I use in Notebook to kind of give you an example of just how great this application is. So I've talked about the clipping service before and doing clippings and how I use that for my research. Well, actually, how you use them once you have Notebook installed, you go in and on any page in a notebook or on any item in your notebook, if it's an outline, something like that, you can control click or right click on the page title or the individual item, and you can add what is called a clipping service. You can also access the clipping service option or add clipping service option from the page or outline menus. And when you do that, you will get a little pair of scissors added to the margin for that page or that item within Notebook. And that means you've now activated a clipping service for that. And then to use that clipping service, all you have to do is go into any application that supports services. So almost every Cocoa application in Mac OS X, select any text or item within that application, and then control click or right click on the item, and using the contextual menu, you will see the notebook section under services. If you don't, you can go and set that up in the system preferences in the keyboard area, or go under the services menu under the application menu for that application, and you'll see notebook, and then you'll see a clip to option, and it'll list the section that you added that clipping service to and the notebook that you're clipping into. You choose that, and whatever you had selected will get clipped into your notebook. Now, you won't leave the application you're working in, so it's, like I said, great for research. You'll hear a little snipping sound as it clips that out and throws it into your notebook, but you can continue to kind of read through your articles, do your research, and then once you're done, you can go to that notebook and to that section where you had that clipping service. You will have all of that information there. And what's great is over in the margin within your notebook, you'll see a little scissors icon to denote that that was clipped from somewhere, and you can control click or right click on that and get some different options for working with that clipping. And if it came from Safari, there's even a snapback link, meaning that you can see the source URL in the source page, a link back to the source page where that clipping came from. So again, great for research because you can go back and re-reference the article and start fleshing out your notes. So that's just one amazingly powerful feature that's in Notebook, along with a bunch of other stuff. If you want to check it all out, you can go to circusponies.com. They have free trials available, and there's some great video tutorials from Don McAllister from Screencasts Online, including a good one that covers in more detail this clipping service. So be sure to check that all out, and a big thank you to Circus Ponies for their support of the MacCast. So let's dive into all of the news that we have to cover, starting with the iPhone 4S and its launch. Demand was incredibly high for the iPhone 4S, despite some people saying it was just a minor upgrade. It didn't seem to stop people from wanting to order them. And Apple announced last Monday that pre-orders for the iPhone 4S topped 1 million units in just 24 hours. And that's despite having some kind of load issues on their ordering system, especially on the AT&T side. I'm going to share with you later in the show sort of my experience with the whole buying process. A little teaser, let's just say it didn't go as smoothly as I would have hoped. I don't, probably not as smoothly as Apple would have hoped either. But the iPhone 4, just for reference, had set Apple's previous pre-order sales record at 600,000 units in 24 hours. So they kind of smashed right through that. AT&T themselves reported that they had sold 200,000 units in just the first 12 hours of availability. I didn't see some updated numbers on how many units AT&T actually pre-sold on the launch day. But most carriers had reported record sales and also activations once the iPhone finally was released just last Friday. Sprint actually reported that the iPhone 4S generated their best launch day sales ever for any device, and they may already be kind of suffering a little bit for it on their data network. Seems to be off to a little bit of a rocky start, at least according to some of the reports that I've been seeing, that performance on Sprint's network, their 3G network, seems to be a little bit slower than maybe Sprint and Verizon. Now, I'm just alluding or assuming that is because of just the sheer volume of iPhone 4s coming on their network, and maybe that'll kind of balance out. But I'd be interested to hear anybody who picked up a Sprint iPhone 4 if they're finding some slowdowns on that network. AT&T broke their previous single day activation record for devices and was actually on track, they said, to double the amount of activations they had done in a single day. I don't know or haven't heard yet whether or not they actually achieved that. Again, their system was kind of crumbling under the load. It ended up being just that they were really delaying activations. Well, again, I'm going to get into that later in the show. I'll tell you about my experience and maybe you can share some of your experiences. But ultimately, I think they got it worked out. It was just that beginning surge, everybody picking up their devices, being very excited and wanting to activate those. And we now know officially from Apple, because they released their sales numbers today, exactly why the data networks were suffering so heavily. They sold 4 million iPhone 4Ss over the launch weekend. That is more than double what they did for the 4S, which I think was about 1.7 million units. So they had that. They also had all the other things going on their network. In their press release, they noted that 25 million people upgraded to iOS 5, and there's a bunch of new features in there. And also 20 million people signed up for iCloud, their new cloud data services. So that's putting a lot of strain on Apple's servers. You know, despite having that big new data center, I think this was probably even more demand than Apple was expecting. But that's great, because that means a lot of us are upgrading, we're using the new services, and Apple's going to get a lot of data from us, a lot of feedback on how this went. But I don't think it quite was as smooth as they had hoped for. As far as how Apple is going to make out with the new iPhone 4S in terms of the bottom line, analyst Chris Whitmore at Deutsche Bank crunched some numbers and believes that Apple's margin on the iPhone 4S could be as high as 73%. So 4 million units, 73% margins, that's going to be a lot more money going into Apple's coffers. Not that Apple's coffers are not already full, but he estimates that Apple's costs on the iPhone 4S for the 16 gigabyte model are about $170, $220 for the 32 gigabyte model. Of course, those numbers are in US dollars. By comparison, the iPod Touch, the margin on that, he estimates, is around 38%. So much higher margin on the iPhone 4S. And Apple also gets about $100 more on the carrier subsidy for an iPhone than comparable smartphones with the carriers, around $450 per device, he estimates, versus about $350 for Apple's competitors. Those subsidies reportedly help Apple lower the price on the iPhone 4S versus their competitors' 4G phones. For example, Samsung, HTC, and Motorola on the Droid, they tend to be about $60 more expensive on a two-year contract if you're comparing phones. So that subsidy really helping Apple their bottom line and helping them stay competitive on the pricing side. And, you know, with these kinds of numbers racking up, these sales kinds of sales numbers racking up, the carriers are going to be willing to give Apple a little bit extra money, because in the long run, that means they've got more people on their networks, more smartphone devices, and can bring in more money with the SMS and data plan messaging. You know, I don't know what that's going to mean for us as consumers. Probably not a good thing for our monthly bills. But either way, Apple doing very well with the new iPhone 4S. Now, one of the things that Apple had started doing in recent years with iPhone launches is launching it in multiple countries, and that also helps boost these numbers, these sales numbers. And one of the big new features of the iPhone 4S, according to Apple, is that it is a world phone. So they have one model sold for both GSM and CDMA networks, and that was kind of a big deal. A lot of people are very excited about the concept of being able to buy an iPhone 4S and then take that globally. So you might buy one on Sprint or Verizon and then be able to travel overseas, get a SIM card, GSM SIM card, put that into your iPhone 4S, and then use that while you're in that country without having to pay the expensive data roaming charges. Well, that may not be the case. There still seems to be a lot of confusion, but there was a great piece over at Tidbits that talked about the world phone aspects of the 4S. The confusion seems to stem from this kind of term unlocked and sort of how the U.S. carriers handle this. And I read through this stuff. I'm even still a little bit confused. But if you want to buy a pure, quote-unquote, unlocked phone, iPhone 4S, directly from Apple, a couple things are going to happen. You're going to have to wait until September. They haven't really gone on sale yet. And if you read the fine print over on Apple's website, you'll note that the unlocked devices are GSM only. So they're not, I guess they don't have the CDMA portion enabled. You're just going to get a GSM unlocked phone. If your carrier is AT&T, only the GSM portions are going to be activated. And when you're on a carrier contract with AT&T, I think that means you also only are able to do the data roaming option when you go overseas and you're on GSM networks, which is much more expensive. You have to get the international data roaming plan from AT&T. So all of those things kind of still apply, even though your new phone is, as Apple says, a world phone and has that world chipset in there. Really just referring to the fact that there's one chipset that can kind of do both networks. Now, it gets a little bit different on the Sprint Verizon side, but even there, according to the details I'm reading, it's sort of kind of unlocked. Sprint, it's being reported, is shipping an unlocked phone right now, but reportedly they're going to shoot out an update that is actually going to lock it. And then you have to be a customer in good standing, meaning you have to be on Sprint for a certain amount of time. Most people are believing 60 days, although Sprint hasn't officially said. But once you've paid your bill for 60 days, then they will unlock the phone for you so you can use the roaming GSM features. And then Verizon has come out and said that they will do a similar thing. They'll unlock the device once you've been in good standing on your bill for 60 days. Then they can unlock that portion, and then you can take it overseas. And then with Sprint and Verizon, you can use that GSM portion. Again, it's the GSM side where you can get a SIM, you can put a GSM in, and then use networks in other countries to get your voice and your data services and things like that. So the capabilities are in there, but it seems like not right away. You're not going to be able to start roaming right away. You're going to have to wait a period of time. So they're still kind of a little bit more closed than what I would call purely open world phones. So, you know, as opposed to just buying a straight up unlocked device, which you're going to pay a lot more for because you don't get that carrier subsidy. The one thing that is a fact and that has been confirmed by iFixit when they did their teardown is it does use Qualcomm's new MDM6610 GSM and CDMA combo chip. So it has the hardware technology in there, but you're going to have to talk to your carrier, find out exactly how the unlock works, whether it involves just data roaming and being able to use other networks, or whether it's truly unlocked and you can use it wherever you want. Right now, all the information I'm getting, it seems like AT&T, it's kind of the same old thing. You got to do the data roaming. With Sprint and Verizon, it's not 100% clear, but it's sounding to me from the reports I'm reading that it will be unlocked after you meet that 60-day requirement, and then you can use it as a world phone. So if you found out differently or you have more information, let me know. Send me some feedback, macast@gmail.com. One of the big new features of that iPhone 4S is the A5 processor. Apple's been designing and building their own processors using manufacturers like Samsung and now Taiwan Semiconductor to help put them help put the chips together. Apple has reportedly made a very big investment in designing and building their own chips. TechCrunch reported that Apple has over 1,000 people working on chips within the company. That represents something like 5% of their workforce. And if you remember, Apple acquired the processor design firm PA Semi back in 2008. Also, flash storage is becoming a more prominent piece in Apple's designs, both with the new MacBook Airs and the iPhones and the iPads. So chips are very, very important to Apple, and they're likely looking to control designs so that they can do things like boost processing power while increasing efficiency and lowering power requirements on their chips. So controlling the processor design allows them to do that with those OEMs, and it means Apple can kind of tailor their chips to their hardware designs and possibly give them a lead over the competition. It seems to be working out very well for them so far. As MacNN points out, the A5 already outperforms new chips from Samsung that are even running at higher clock speeds. So Apple's competing with Samsung on their hardware products. Samsung's making the chips for Apple, or has been making the A5 chips for Apple, and Apple's chips are actually outperforming Samsung's own designs. So that's a pretty big deal. And it's looking like Apple may be the first company out with a chip using a new 28-nanometer design process. That would be the A6. And there's some debate on who's actually going to be OEMing that for Apple. Recent rumors had said that Taiwan Semiconductor had won the award for that. They have some new factories coming online that would be able to do the 28-nanometer process. But then I just saw a report today that Samsung may be still doing those chips for Apple, and it might be a production capacity issue. Taiwan Semiconductor reportedly doesn't have enough capacity in the 28-nanometer range to be able to do that, but the A6 reportedly a new quad-core processor, which would significantly boost performance and probably will show up, most people are thinking, in the iPad 3, which we're starting to hear some rumors is already starting to ramp up, and designs are coming through, and Apple might be starting production soon. They have the new production facility down in Brazil, which could be cranking out iPads, so something's happening, probably first quarter of 2012, right on schedule for the yearly iPad update is when we'll be getting the iPad 3, if I were to guess. So stay tuned for that. That's a kind of, I think now that we have the iPhone 4S out of the way, iPad 3 rumors are going to be the big ones moving forward and through the end of the year into next year. And I guess we'll close out with one other recent rumor that surfaced, and that is a possible update to the Apple TV. 9to5 Mac noted a reference string inside the release of iOS 5 stating that there was an Apple TV model 3.1. It was noted in there, and currently the little black box from Apple is 2.1. So it's not surprising that Apple would be working on a new model, and the reference being there doesn't really give us a timeline for exactly when Apple would release that, but we can kind of start to speculate on what the specs might look like, and some of the rumor sites are starting to do just that. New Apple TV would likely bring an A5 processor. That seems like a logical upgrade. Also, more RAM. And why would you want to do that? Well, 1080p video. The new iPhone 4S can shoot 1080p, so people are going to want to be able to play that back on their device, and you're going to need a little bit more horsepower under the hood in that Apple TV to do that. Maybe some more storage, so that you can do a little bit more buffering and streaming. Games are also becoming prominent to Apple. If you watched the iPhone 4S launch event, Apple kind of highlighted games as a big thing for iOS. They may want to start bringing some of those onto the Apple TV, especially we've seen Bluetooth support may be rumored, which would allow controllers and maybe better control over game development. Apple's experimented with games in the past. If you remember the Pippin way back a long time ago, it never really saw the light of day, but they did play around with it, and games are obviously making some money for Apple on the App Store. So people like to play games on their TV, and it could be the next extension of a next generation device. But Apple, you know, the Apple TV is still kind of hobby for Apple. So I think they do some experimenting. I think they're willing to take a little more risks on that device. I don't know that Apple wants to get into the game business, but it's something to think about. Certainly on the video side, though, bumping up the processor and the RAM can help just with the quality and some of the streaming services. Apple continues to add new streaming services, and they did with the latest update to the Apple TV software when iOS 5 came out. So that's kind of it. That's what I got for the news for this week. We're going to dive into a lot of stuff with my impressions of iOS 5, the new iPhone 4S, iCloud, and all those services and stuff like that here in a minute. But before I get to that, I want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, Gazelle. Hey, if you're looking to earn some extra cash, maybe to fund the purchase of a new device, maybe a new iPhone 4S, Gazelle is a service you should check out. It makes it really easy to get cash for your old electronics devices. So they call themselves a re-commerce service. So they do recycling, but where they start is with reuse. And the way it works is they offer you cash for your old stuff. They recondition it, they bring it in, they remove all of the data securely and safely so you don't have to worry about that, and then they repurpose it, they resell that. So how it works for you is you simply go on the site, you search for the product that you own that you want to get some cash for. They have a huge database, and it's continuing to grow all the time. You answer a few questions about the condition and the accessories that you have, and then they make you an offer. Right there on the screen, they'll say, we'll give you this much for it. And if you choose to take that cash offer, if it's an item of value, they will cover the shipping costs, and they provide both shipping to Gazelle and return shipping as well. So if they get it in and they assess the condition differently, they'll make you another offer. It might be different than the original one. If you decide at that point, nope, I don't want to take that, they will send it back to you, and there's no cost to you for that. So really no risk in sending it to them. And it takes the hassles out of you having to list it on an auction site or throw it up on some sort of classified ad and deal with all those transactions. You know what you're going to get right up front. And it really just is that simple. And then if you have an item where it doesn't have any value, they can't make you an offer on it, you can still send it in to them. You'll have to pay shipping in that case, but they will recycle it responsibly, and you don't have to worry about it because they use credited and certified recycling partners like CloudBlue. So great service. You can check it all out, get more information and details, and you know, see what your old devices are worth over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So I guess we'll kind of take things in the order that they came out, starting with iOS 5, and then we'll move to some of the new apps, iCloud, some of the app updates, and then the iPhone 4S, my buying experience, as well as my experience using the new device. And then we, like I said, have a little bit of feedback from one of you on some firewall issues related to iTunes. So let's just talk about how the launch of iOS 5 went, and also some of the new features and some of the things that I'm enjoying and liking and maybe not liking so much about iOS 5. So the upgrade process for me, in a word, was frustrating. The lesson I think here is don't stay up late on the launch day and trying to be one of the very first people to get the update. It was one of those kinds of things where I was tired. It was really late. I was up working, to be honest with you, up working on the show, doing show notes and stuff like that. So I thought, you know, I'll just stay up. Midnight will come around. They had heard rumors that they were supposed to be releasing it about 12:01 on Wednesday the 12th. So right when that hit, of course, you start hitting Apple's servers, and at that point, everything goes south because it's not just you doing it, right? It's a million or 25 million, we know now, other people trying to access it all at the same time. Well, probably not everybody was up waiting up, but I think a good 5 million or so must have been, because I just could not get in. A lot of people were tweeting out that they couldn't get in. There were errors. And I got completely frustrated. And again, don't tweet when you're tired. So if you were up and saw sort of my tirades, it looked like I was a lot more upset than I really was. I was mainly just frustrated with the whole process, because you would think that Apple would, over the years they've been doing this enough, be kind of prepared for that sort of thing. But they obviously weren't. So the solution was go to bed, get up in the morning when you're nice and rested, and just do the install then. And it went fine after that. It was just that initial push that I think really caused some of the upgrade problems. Immediately, one of the nice new things that I noticed was the on-device setup. So you do the installation, you know, you reinstall the OS, and then if you don't restore from backup, if you set it up as a new device, you can do the entire setup process. This is part of the whole PC free thing. You can do the whole setup process right on the device. You don't have to connect it to iTunes anymore. You can get your new device set up right out of the box. And with the new iCloud backup service, if you start using that, I'm hearing that you can actually pull all your data down from the cloud. So it's going to be amazing to be able to have an iOS device, an iPhone, an iPod Touch, or an iPad, and not have to have it tethered at all to a PC or a Mac to get it and use it. And I think that's going to increase the sales, especially of iPad 2s, to consumers who maybe don't want to have a PC at all. They can use free iCloud service to do their backups, still save their data. And I think that is going to be a really nice feature that a lot of people enjoy. One other upgrade hiccup that I heard about from a fellow podcaster and friend of the show, George Starcher. You've heard him on here before. He hit a gotcha when he tried to do his upgrade. If you've ever jailbroken your device any time in the past, this might affect you. You might get an error about the device not being eligible for upgrade. And the reason for that turns out that it may have gone in the jailbreak software, whichever one you used, and I guess multiple versions do this, may have gone in and edited or modified your host's file. And for those of you who don't know what that is, you don't really need to worry about it. Basically, there's a little file locally on your Mac. It's at /etc/hosts. That file actually controls, it's the first place your Mac will look for a DNS, a domain name service lookup. And you can kind of override some of the settings in there. So what the jailbreaks do is they go in and they add an entry in that file for gs.apple.com. And then they point that not at Apple, but at Cydia, which helps facilitate and enable the jailbreak. So if you've hit this device not eligible for upgrade message, you're going to need to go in there and remove that listing from your host file. And once again, if you don't know what that is or you don't know what you're doing, you should be careful, because you know messing with this file too much could kind of break some DNS stuff within your system. But if you're doing jailbreak, you should know what all this stuff means and how to get into the terminal and edit that. And removing that entry will allow you to go ahead and then upgrade to iOS 5. So just wanted to point that out, and thanks to George for sending that along. But let's talk about some of the new features and some of the things that I'm really enjoying right out of the box. Notifications, you know, are great. The new notification systems, you pull down from the top, you get a listing of the history of your notifications. On the lock screen, you can now have multiple notifications, not just the one that then overrides the other one. A feature people have been wanting for a really long time. Other devices have it. It does work fairly well. The one thing I have to say for me is it almost works too well, because it's almost too much. There's like too many notifications going on. So you really need to manage it. And luckily, iOS 5 provides a lot of settings for actually managing your notifications in the notification center. And you can go into your settings and just adjust that. And you can do it per app. You can control things like how many you want to show up in Notification Center, whether you want them to show up in Notification Center or not, whether you want them to show up on the lock screen, if you want an alert style, a badge style, all those things are completely configurable. So you're going to have to adjust your settings for different apps to kind of get notifications to be custom tailored to how you want it to work. But that's great. I mean, Apple giving us all that control makes the notification system really, really good. And I think it's now as good as it is on some of the other devices. Apple, you know, people are going to say that Apple borrowed that feature from Android. And if they did, I'm fine with that, because it's great. I'm really enjoying that feature. Another awesome feature is iMessage. You can now message from your iPad and your iPod Touch using your Apple ID. You can register additional emails to it. So you can send messages, you can receive messages on those devices. And if you have an iPhone, It will automatically, if you are messaging from your iPhone to another iOS device, it will automatically switch over from SMS to iMessage. And it's really a seamless process, and it makes it easy to know because it gives you a little dividing line that says, okay, you're now in iMessage. Also, the color of the send button will change from green to blue, or from blue to green. Sorry, I got that backwards. From blue when you're sending SMS over to green when you start using iMessage. And that means you're now on Apple's messaging service and you're not paying, or you're not decrementing against your SMS plan. So I have a feeling in some cases, depending on how your usage of SMS goes and how many of your friends and family have iOS devices, you may be able to roll back and get a cheaper, less expensive SMS messaging plan. And I think that's going to be a great for a lot of people. And again, you can assign multiple email addresses to your messages settings. So if you want people to be able to reach you through iMessage using different email addresses, you can make that happen. You kind of register them with Apple's servers. And there was an interesting thing. I hope Apple rolls this out into the address book to make it more obvious who has iMessage. But the first time you send a message to somebody who has iMessage, you'll notice the color change from the green to the blue. The next time you go into the Messages app and you click the little, you know, compose new message, and you start typing in the to field, that person's name, if they have iMessage enabled, will pop up and it'll have a little blue chat icon kind of next to it, indicating that that is the iMessage address. Again, I was hoping this doesn't come up if you hit the little plus symbol and just go through the address book contacts. You only see it if you start doing that, if you start typing in that to field and that it does the autocomplete, and you won't see it until after you've sent that person an iMessage for the first time. So I saw this and it was like I couldn't find it again any other place, and then suddenly realized that it is a very specific situation where it pops up. So I hope that gets rolled out universally. It'd be great to just pull up your address, your contact list, and see all the people that have iMessage enabled quickly and easily. But really enjoying the new iMessage feature. The camera, can I just talk about some of the new camera features? The volume, using the volume button to take a photo, great. Makes it really quick and easy. Being able to access the camera from the lock screen. So if you're on the lock screen, you do a double tap, you'll get the little camera icon. This works on the iPhone, and I'm assuming the iPod Touch. It does not work on the iPad, the iPad 2. There's been some debate on why that feature is or is not there on the iPad 2. I think it would be easy enough for Apple to add for those people who want to have the option. A lot of people argue, well, why would you want to take photos with your iPad 2? Well, the reality is some people do. I've seen people out and about with iPad 2s at different locations, tourist locations, taking photos with an iPad. So no software reason why Apple shouldn't be able to enable that feature, but it isn't there. So if you have an iPad or an iPad 2 and you've been looking for that feature, that's why you're not finding it. The other nice thing about the new camera application is the built-in editing, so you can do some basic enhancing. I'm real appreciative of the cropping feature. I've had third-party apps for doing cropping, and Apple's is, you know, simple, basic, so if you need more, you probably still want to use a third-party app, but at least you can now crop a photo, you can rotate it, you can do some of the adjustments right there without having to get another application, some of the basic adjustments that you might want to do. And that's a nice update to iOS 5. Wireless syncing is another feature that a lot of people have wanted for a really long time. Some things you need to know about wireless syncing. I was never all that excited about it because even over USB 2, if you're syncing a lot of data, it can be pretty slow. But I guess if you want to just be able to have your device being constantly updated in the background and being synced up, this is a nice feature to enable. You do have to enable it. I don't think it comes on by default. You go into iTunes when the device is connected on USB, and you will see it in the settings there in the info panel. Also, you can enable it on the device by going into Settings, General, and looking for the iTunes Wi-Fi sync. And it only syncs under some specific situations, so you need to be aware of this. It will sync automatically when you're plugged into power, so you have to be docked and plugged into power and connected obviously to the same Wi-Fi network as your Mac. When those two things happen and you have this setting turned on, then that's when the syncing will happen. If you're not connected to power, it's not going to sync. You can, in those situations, enable a sync manually by going into the iTunes Wi-Fi sync settings and hitting the button, but you have to force that to happen. And then, of course, you can still sync with your docking cable when plugging it into iTunes. And I've used it, and it works just fine over a Wi-Fi network, if not a little bit slow. So depending on the amount of data you're syncing, if you've updated a lot of photos or if you're updating a lot of music, it can take a little while. But if it happens overnight while you're docked and recharging your phone, well, then you're ready to go in the morning and you don't have to actually plug it into a device. So another area where it's less dependent on the Mac or the PC to continue to be working. AirPlay mirroring. Let's talk about that feature. If you have an Apple TV 2, this feature is awesome. It really just works right out of the box. Enables you to basically broadcast anything that is on your screen over to a large screen monitor. It's going to be great for doing presentations. For someone like me who has to go out and show off my iPad, you know, docking in with the cable is great, but to be able to do it wirelessly and just bring my Apple TV along, plug that into a projector that supports HDMI output from the Apple TV, it'll make doing presentations a lot more fluid. I can move around the stage. I can just be carrying my iPad. It supports the rotation. And this feature wasn't really obvious how you enable it at first. You actually enable it from the multitasking bar from the media controls. So, you know, you do the double tap on the home button or using the new gestures, swipe up to get to the multitasking bar, and then, you know, swipe over to the right so that you get the media controls. And then I think you actually have to do it twice if you're on the iPhone or the iPod Touch. And then from the little AirPlay button, you can scroll down and you should see the mirroring options to mirror the display wirelessly over AirPlay to your Apple TV 2. In general, performance-wise, it's very responsive, very little delay and lag from the few times that I've used it, and there have been a lot of great reviews. I haven't done it with a game yet, but a lot of people are saying for doing games on a big screen from your iPhone, your iPod Touch, or your iPad, it's supposed to be truly awesome. So a lot of people are enjoying the mirroring support in games. Twitter integration, you know, I use Twitter quite a bit to do MacCast stuff, and that has made it pretty convenient to use the iPhone now. I've used it with the photo application. It's really nice to be able to just go into a photo and automatically be able to send a tweet from that. What happens in applications that have integrated the Twitter integration is you get what's called a tweet sheet that pops down. So you hit the share button in most applications, hit the tweet option, get this little tweet sheet, and you can fill that out. You set up Twitter and the Twitter integration right from the, you need to have the Twitter app installed, but right in the general settings now, you can add multiple accounts and do it that way. And you need to allow different applications. You can control which applications are allowed to access the Twitter integration also from that settings control panel. So it's easy to set up, easy to use, and you don't have to be constantly logging into your Twitter account or having every application that has Twitter integration ask you for your login information. You enter it once in the settings, and then you're good to go. You just have to allow that application to access Twitter. And I'm finding that feature to be particularly helpful. There's also new custom tones and alerts. Somebody already emailed me to ask me to go into this feature in more detail. I'm not a big tone, sounds, alert person, but it's in the settings under sounds. And then there is, when you go in there, there is a new tone store and stuff in the iTunes store. And you can click a button and access that. They have all kinds of tones. I noticed there's a bunch of Star Wars tones and stuff that you can purchase and download and put onto your device. And you can assign custom tones in a lot more places. There's also custom vibrations that you can set up, although I think that's been in there. I can't remember if that was a part of iOS 5 or if that was added earlier, but you can play around with those settings, and there's a lot more places where you can add tones. So you can change your new email tone, the email sent tone, what sound you hear when you do a tweet on Twitter, also voicemail alerts, calendar alerts, all those things can be completely customized, and you can bring in your own custom tones. Again, I'll try and cover this in a future tip on the MacCast, how to actually maybe build your own custom tones, bring those in from GarageBand and stuff like that, which you can do. But you can use the new tone store if you just want to purchase them in the meantime. And then a couple features exclusive to the iPad 2 that I am really enjoying. The multitasking gestures, again, you enable those from the settings, but you have a four-finger swipe up to access the multitasking bar. You have the four-finger swipe left or right to move between your recent applications. I find that one particularly helpful, especially when you're trying to jump between different apps. So when I'm using Reader on my iPad to then do my show notes over in Omni Outliner, I can swipe back and forth. Or if I need to swipe over to Notebook or something like that, it's just jumping back and forth to copy and paste things becomes really much more efficient without having to do the whole double tap. It saves a lot of motion. And then this one I don't use too much, but a lot of people really like it to close out of an application, the four finger pinch in to go back to the home screen to access your application launcher. But I haven't found myself personally using that too much. The other feature that is new to the iPad 2, is the split keyboard. And that one I really do like, especially when I'm in landscape mode on the iPad and I need to type some stuff, to be able to just type with my thumbs and it's, you know, hold the iPad in front of me. That makes that much more convenient. It was before you'd kind of just have to cradle the iPad and then take one hand off and type if you didn't have it on a desk, you know, if you're just trying to use it handheld. And so using an iPad handheld with the split finger keyboard is really, really nice under iOS 5. So those are, of course, not all of the features. I think there's over 200 new features in iOS 5, something like that. These are the ones that I've particularly enjoyed and started using and playing around with. If you have some features that have become important to you with iOS 5 that you're really enjoying, send your feedback along. Send me an email or an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. So let's talk a little bit about some of the new applications Apple also released with iOS 5 and the iPhone 4S. One of the biggest changes people will notice right away, especially on the iPhone, is it's now just like the iPod Touch. The music app is the replacement for the iPod app. And then on the iPad, I guess there's some changes. I don't use the iPad music app all that often, but this came up on the latest We Have Communicators with Michael Johnston and Jeff Gamet, and they were saying they didn't like some of the differences. Specifically noted were how it handles the scrubber bar up at the top. I guess now it's just a little line instead of a dot, and it's kind of hard to grab that little red line. And then within the artists' albums section, or I guess specifically the artists' section, there's no way to view just a general line listing like you can in songs, where you just get the song title and the artist name and the album name. Under artists, it now has the album covers. And I'm not really certain how it decides which cover to display. It probably has something to do with the sort order. But you have to, you know, click on the cover, and then you get that little flip around, or then it swaps over, excuse me, to the album listing view, and you can play songs from that. And I guess that's a change. I don't know if it was that way before or not, because again, I don't really use the music app on my iPad all that much. I'm usually using either iTunes on my Mac or my iPod. But that's a significant change. For videos, those are now all in the videos app, and so you have your video podcasts, your movies, your TV shows, and things like that in that area. So separate applications, again, kind of just the way the iPod Touch has always sort of been. Another new app is the Cards app from Apple. This one was one of the ones that was demoed at the launch event, and it allows you to actually send physical cards, real cards, through the mail using your iPhone, your iPod, or I think it's a universal app. I haven't tried it on the iPad yet, but I tried it out on my iPhone, and it's a beautifully designed app. It works really well. I haven't actually sent a card yet, but I've been able to save off a couple ones that I'm planning on sending. They have a bunch of different card templates. So when you bring it up, they have different categories. They have a thank you category, holidays, of course, baby announcements. Pretty much what they've done, it looks like what they've done for the most part, is taken the card feature that's built into iPhoto and sort of built that into its own separate app. I'm not 100% positive if all the templates are exactly the same, but there are those nice letterpress cards that Apple creates. The big difference being that you can send just one. So you don't have to buy a whole kind of set or package. You can just generate and send an individual card. You put the text on there. You put in the sending address and the receiving address. And I believe the pricing works out to $2.99 to send a card in the U.S. and then $4.99 internationally. I'm not sure how many stores this app is available on. I don't know if it's U.S. only at this point. But I'm sure that if it is, Apple is trying to roll it out to more countries. I know it gets frustrating for international listeners that Apple tends to roll things out in the U.S. first, but I have to imagine that it's just easier for them to do it that way and then try and work out getting it launched in other countries as they move along. It seems to be Apple's typical MO when they're rolling out new apps and new services and things like that. Another new service is the Find My Friends service. That was also demoed by Eddie Q during the announcement. And this is the one that Jeff Kamet is calling Stalk My Friends. I have a feeling, I haven't played around with this one yet. I haven't set it up. It allows you to send out your location to other people that have the app. It's a purely opt-in thing. So the way it works, and I've received a couple of these requests already, if you install the Find My Friends app, you can request that somebody share their location with you, somebody else who has an iOS device and is on the iFriends service. And so once they approve you, then you'll be able to see their location within the application. Another nice feature is you can enable that for specific time periods, so you don't have to have it always on. So you can give approval for, you know, certain days and certain times. And that might be particularly useful for if you're having an event, say like Macworld. When I go to Macworld, it'll be great to do this with other people attending the conference, and then we can all kind of report our positions to each other and find each other as the show goes on, and you can meet up with people. We'll make meeting up a lot easier, I would imagine. And then you can just set it to automatically turn that off and not share your location once the event is over. And I have also a feeling that it's going to be particularly useful for families. So this is a service I tend to keep very private. I know I've received, like I said, some requests from some of you to share my location. I'm going to not do that. If you want to share your location with me in that respect, I'm on Foursquare. I do Twitter. I do a lot of other services that give out location information that I can kind of control and consider to be a little bit more public, that I'm willing to be a little bit more public with. But I think friends and family is going to be a really exactly that for your close friends, your close family. And I have a feeling people are going to keep that as a pretty protected inner circle. I don't see any need to kind of open that up. Another thing that is important for the whole PC-free aspect of using an iOS device, Apple put out an airport utility for managing your airport base stations, Airport Extreme, Airport Express. And I tried this app out, and it's really nice. It's got a great simple interface when you first launch it. Kind of shows you your network. You can log in to manage your different airports, and you can really, it looks like, control almost every setting. I was wondering if you could control like the NAT firewalling stuff, and you, when you drill down, I'm appreciating how they have it layered. So it kind of gives you a really simple interface at first, and then you can get into the basic settings and then kind of drill down into the more advanced settings. And I was able to do most functions, including things like resetting a router, opening up and setting up specific ports, and port forwarding is in there. And you can really do everything that you could do with the desktop app, airport utility app, but now on an iOS device. And it looks like it integrates with the settings for your Wi-Fi hotspot as well. So when you go into settings under Wi-Fi and select the network that you're connected to, click the little blue arrow and scroll down to the bottom, there's a manage this network option. And if you click that and have the app installed, it'll actually launch the app and allow you to manage your airport network and configure things and get stuff set up. So all of these apps are free downloads from the App Store if you haven't picked any of them up yet. And then that's not all. Apple also added Newsstand to iOS 5. So if you have any magazine or newspaper subscriptions, that will show up once you've run the iOS 5 update. And something to note there, it will only show magazines or newspapers that are installed on that device. So I was really confused at first because I didn't have any magazines or newspapers in Newsstand on my iPhone. And then I realized it's because I don't have any of those installed. I don't have any of those applications or didn't have any of those applications installed on my iOS device. And once you do the upgrade to iOS 5, it will automatically move those magazines into Newsstand for you. So if you had them in other folders, they're going to get moved over. And it looks like it shows the cover of the current issue for whatever newspaper or magazine that you have installed right in the interface inside Newsstand. And then you can tap the button and it just launches the standard application that you had installed before. So that's kind of how Newsstand works. It just kind of collects and coalesces all of your magazines and newspapers in that single location. The new Reminders application that's part of iOS 5, that allows you to quickly and easily add to-do list items and reminders. You can put those into different categories if you'd like, and it enables you to set up the geofence, what Apple calls a geofence reminder, meaning that you can go into the reminder, go into the additional settings, and put a location in there to remind you if you arrive at that location or if you're leaving that location. It can give you a pop-up and say, hey, did you remember to grab that portfolio because you're heading out to that meeting where you're going to meet with your clients? And so you can set up those types of reminders. The one thing that I discovered about that feature to note is that the location needs to be in your address book to be able to set up the geofence, which is a bit inconvenient if you're planning on, you know, you want a reminder for when you get to the grocery store that you need to pick up something. Well, you have to actually add the grocery store that you go to your address book. I'm not sure why Apple made it that way, but it is that way now. I'm hoping in the future they change that option, that you'll be able to just put in an address and use that address as the geolocation fence location. And then the last app that just kind of showed up in the App Store, I don't think it was really announced, but Apple released a Trailers application for iOS, and it's actually really nice. You launch it and it has all of the movie trailers. It's kind of reminiscent of the Trailers application that's on the Apple TV. So I don't know if this is more of that kind of iOS round tripping that's going on, but you can view trailers, you can see the release calendar for upcoming movies, and they kind of have a nice interface for that, a scroll left right interface with all of the different album art kind of scrolling down from the dates that are lined up across the top. They have a top 25 list showing the most popular trailers, the weekend box office hits, and reviews from Rotten Tomatoes and from iTunes. There is an in theaters option that shows you what's currently in the theaters. You can also put in your location or your zip code and get show times, although it doesn't look like you can actually order tickets. But you can get showtimes for movies that are showing in your area, and you can even favorite some things. And it's, you know, I really like it when these apps have the reviews from Rotten Tomatoes. Hopefully they'll add some other ones because I like to check a couple different ones. You know, so this is very similar to a lot of the third-party movie apps that are out there, but more focused, I think, on the trailer aspect and then some of these additional features in there. But beautiful app, of course, because it's from Apple and designed by Apple. And that's probably of the ones that have been released, the Trailers app, oddly enough, might be my favorite one. So let's move on to iCloud. A lot of people have a lot of questions about iCloud. I had a lot of questions about iCloud. I wasn't sure what I was going to do because I have been a MobileMe user. Actually, I've been whatever flavor of cloud service Apple has offered, I've been a user of it. So starting with iTunes, going to .Mac and then to MobileMe, I've kind of gone along the Apple path. And with iCloud coming out, there's a lot of questions about Apple IDs, your existing MobileMe accounts, and your new iCloud accounts. And I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do because I rely on MobileMe to do my syncing. It's the same account that's tied to the Apple ID that I use for the iTunes Store and my App Store purchases and things like that. And I'm in a little bit of a dilemma there because the Apple ID that I use, which is my MobileMe email address, is shared by myself and my wife so that we can share our iTunes purchases and our app purchases. And so both her Mac and my Macs are tied to that same account. And when you go through the iCloud conversion process with an existing MobileMe account, everything gets converted over. And I didn't want to necessarily do that. So I was doing some researching online, and everything that I was reading pointed to, if you share an ID, an Apple ID, for your iTunes store purchases and for your App Store purchases, that you might not want to convert that over to an iCloud account if you're transitioning to iCloud. And I'm going to tell you what I did. I don't know at this point that what I did was what everybody should do. There's still some confusion about how iCloud works and Apple IDs. The one thing I do know that's fairly certain from everything that I've been reading is that there is no way, and Apple doesn't even have a way, to merge two Apple IDs together. So if you have separate Apple IDs, they are going to stay separate. And your Apple ID, you use an Apple ID to sign up for an iCloud account. And that's important. And then you also need to think about, is your Apple ID, which is a .me email address, or you can get a .me email address for, is that tied to a MobileMe account? So you have all these things to kind of think about. So here's what I did. I went with a new separate account from my MobileMe account. And again, my decision to do that was because my MobileMe account was tied to the Apple ID that I used for iTunes purchases, and that is shared by myself and my wife. I want to make that really clear because I think that's important to my specific situation. So my first dilemma was, how do I create a new iCloud account with a new Apple ID? And that took me a little bit of time to figure out, because when I tried to log in to iCloud.com, or when I went to iCloud.com, it wanted an Apple ID. And if I put in my MobileMe information, it was telling me it was going to convert over all my MobileMe stuff, which I didn't want. So I had to go to appleid.apple.com and create a brand new Apple ID. So I think I now have three different Apple IDs, because I have one for the developer program, I have the one that is my MobileMe, my existing MobileMe account, and I now have this new one that I set up for iCloud. So I created that account, and then I went to iCloud.com and signed in with that new Apple ID. And that whole process went great. That was perfectly fine. I now had a new Apple ID. I now had a new iCloud account. And then it was just a matter of setting up my Mac running Lion and setting up my devices running iOS 5. And you need to be running iOS 5 and Lion to use iCloud. So that's another thing to think about. If you haven't converted your Mac over to Lion, and you're using MobileMe for your syncing, you're probably going to want to stay on MobileMe. And MobileMe is going to be active. The services on MobileMe are going to be active until June of 2012. So you have some time, but at some point you are going to have to convert over. And I don't know, it's not clear at this point, if Apple's ever going to support iCloud on Snow Leopard. And I don't know what that means for older computers or older Macs that can't run Lion. I guess we're going to have to wait and see if Apple, I have to imagine that Apple will have to give folks some sort of upgrade path or some sort of update so that they can continue to use Apple's cloud-based services. But the very first thing that I wanted to do was convert all my stuff over. So I had MobileMe syncing set up, and now I wanted to set up iCloud syncing. And if you do a conversion, if you just take your existing MobileMe account and convert that over to an iCloud account, this all happens, it's my understanding, kind of automatically. In the background, it'll migrate all your data over to iCloud, and then you can shut off your MobileMe services and then just enable your iCloud services on your devices. It'll move over your contacts and your calendars and all that sort of thing. In my case, because I was creating a new Apple ID, it was a little bit more of a manual process. And again, this is what I did. I still haven't determined, and I've already discovered at least one area where I think I made a mistake, that this is the best way, but it's how I sort of did it. And there's more information coming out, and we'll continue to share different methods and different gotchas and stuff like that on future episodes of the MacCast. But here is what I did. Once again, I don't know that this is the best method. This is just the method that I use, so I'll share it with you. And I already know that in one instance, I kind of had a little gotcha, and I'll point that out to you. I'll tell you what happened. But let's start on my Mac. So the very first thing that I did is I took this new iCloud account. I went to my system preferences. I went into iCloud, and I logged into my new iCloud Apple ID and set up the syncing, contacts, calendar, bookmarks, all of those sorts of things. And that seemed to work just fine. And so at this point, I have Mobile Me syncing and iCloud syncing kind of running together. And I want to turn off Mobile Me syncing because I don't want the duplicates. I don't want the extra information. And they are kind of separate services, separate databases, I think, up in the cloud. At least that's the way it seems to me. And so I just wanted to verify everything was working. And when I went to look at my contacts, that was fine. I had iCloud contacts and I had MobileMe contacts that were duplicated, but I was going to go turn the MobileMe ones off. So everything's okay there. Then on the calendar side in iCal, and I actually don't use iCal, I use BusyCal. So I went into BusyCal and there was an update for BusyCal to support iCloud. So I got that update. And then I logged into my new Apple ID, and I don't know why I didn't think about this, but with respect to calendars, MobileMe is CalDAV. It's all on the server. There are no local calendars, and I did have a couple local calendars just that were on my Mac, quote-unquote, on my Mac calendars set up. When I went to look at iCloud after it did its syncing, I noticed that I had some duplicate information, and I also had none of my MobileMe calendars were over on the iCloud side. And my first reaction was to kind of start to panic, and I went, oh my gosh, why do I have duplicate data? And, oh, something's gone very, very wrong. And then I realized the problem was that, oh, I don't have that data up in iCloud. I don't have any of my MobileMe calendars are not in iCloud because they're sitting on Apple servers over on the MobileMe side and not on the iCloud side. So I have to get them over. And since I didn't convert my existing MobileMe account, Apple didn't migrate them over for me. I was going to have to do that process manually. And then when I started looking at what the duplicate calendars were, what it was or what it appears to have done was take my on my Mac calendars, and it did, when I enabled iCloud, push those up onto the iCloud server. So I had my local copies, and then I had the ones that were syncing in from iCloud, and so that's where the duplicates were. So in that case, I could just delete the local ones, or I could go delete the iCloud ones, but I just wanted everything in iCloud. So I went ahead and I just removed the local ones from on my Mac, and then everything was okay in terms of the duplicates. The next challenge was, oh, how do I get my old MobileMe data into iCloud? And probably went without saying, but I probably should have mentioned earlier, I did a backup of all of my calendar data and all of my address book data before I even started messing with any of this, because I wanted to make sure I wasn't going to lose anything. So go into the contacts application and export a contact archive. And I went into the calendar, into iCal, and exported an iCal archive of all of my calendar and contact data. So I had that. So I knew I had a fallback so I could kind of mess with this stuff with the impunity. And so deleted those calendars. Now, to migrate everything, it was a pretty simple process as well. I just went to each calendar that was on MobileMe in iCal, and I just did an ICS export. I exported that calendar and did that for each calendar that I had. And then in iCal, I added a new calendar to iCal, or to iCloud, excuse me, for each calendar that I needed to migrate, and giving it the same name. So for example, if I had a home calendar in MobileMe, which I did, I created a new calendar on the iCloud account called Home. And I did that for each one of my calendars that I had just exported. And then all I had to do was import those ICS files into the appropriate calendar that I had just created on the iCloud account. So I moved all of those in. And then, of course, I had duplicate entries now because I had the MobileMe versions and I had the iCloud versions of the same calendar. But again, remember that these are two separate systems, and we're going to go turn off, or I was going to go turn off MobileMe after this whole process had completed. So did all of that. And once I confirmed everything had moved over, then I went to the system preference pane. I went into Mobile Me and I turned off Mobile Me syncing. And I just turned off everything. There's a couple services, keychain syncing, mail syncing, mail preferences syncing, a couple of other services that are not making the transition to iCloud. It's not clear at this point if Apple will ever add support for those features back in. And so some people might want to leave syncing on for certain services because you can have the two together. MobileMe doesn't get shut down until June of next year, so you can run the two concurrently, but I just wanted to make a clean break. So I turned off MobileMe syncing completely. And then once I did that, my calendars resolved and my contacts resolved. So I only have my iCloud information in both those locations, and everything seemed to be syncing fine. So that was that. The only other thing I then had to do at that point was configure my iOS devices. And it was a somewhat similar process. I went in to the settings on each device. I went into mail, contacts, and calendars, and I went under my MobileMe account, and I just flipped the little switches to turn off calendar and contact syncing. And when you do that on a MobileMe device, it will ask you, what do you want to do with the data? Do you want to remove it from the device, or do you want to leave a copy on the device? And my thinking was that since contacts didn't live in the cloud, at least in my opinion, you know, it syncs. Contacts sync with your desktop. I decided to keep my contacts on my devices. So I said, you know, don't delete the contacts from the devices because I was worried it was going to delete something. For calendars, because the calendar data lives on the server in the cloud through CalDAV, I did the opposite. I said, go ahead and remove the calendar data. You know, don't leave any local calendar data on the device because I was going to get that from iCloud. So those were the two choices I made. And it's that first choice, the contacts choice, that in hindsight I realized was a mistake, because later in the week or a couple days later, I was looking at my contacts and I would notice that in the main section, in the groups section, it was split out and it showed contacts on my device and then contacts on iCloud, and there were duplicate contacts. But when I would go into the all contacts area, I would only see one listing, which is a little bit different than it had been in the past. You used to kind of see duplicates. Well, now when I would click on a contact and then scroll to the bottom of that contact's detail, it would show that it was joined to the version that was in iCloud. So there were really two contacts, one locally on the device and one synced up from iCloud. And I guess you're going to have to make your choice on this one, but I decided I didn't want to have linked duplicates. I just wanted to have the one location, the iCloud location. So I'm having iCloud for contacts work just like it does for my calendars, where all the data is in the cloud and everything syncs to my device. And so I should have, when it asked me the first time when I turned off the MobileMe contacts, if I wanted to leave the data on the device, I should have said no. I should have said go ahead and remove the data from the device, because when I flipped on iCloud, then it would have synced back down to my contacts and I'd only have the one listing. So to kind of reverse the procedure, to reverse the mistake, it was relatively easy. I just had to go into the settings, into mail, contacts, and calendars under iCloud, turn off contacts. Again, it would pop up and ask me what I wanted to do with the data. I said, you know, remove the local data, don't keep it. So that wiped out all of my contacts on my iOS device, which again is a little bit panicking at first, but the minute I turned contacts back on, it popped up, said, what do you want to do with the iCloud data? Do you want to merge it to this device? You select merge, and then everything pulled back down, but only from iCloud. So I no longer had that duplicate data, and it was all cleaned up. So repeat the same procedure for all of my iOS devices, and everything so far has gone great. It looks good. I've got all my data, no duplicates, and I haven't had any issues using the new iCloud syncing. Couple other iCloud services that I've been playing around with. Photo streaming is incredible. It works really well. I was out and about shooting some photos after turning this on, and there is an update for iPhoto. iPhoto 11 9.2 update enables the cloud streaming features. There was also an update, or the photo streaming features, excuse me. There was also an update for Aperture 3.2 that adds the same thing. So if you're an iPhoto or Aperture user and want to use iCloud Photo Stream, you need to get those updates. But anything that I shoot on my iPhone goes up to iCloud automatically, up to 1,000 pictures, doesn't count against my online storage. And when I get back home, or when I got back home and pulled up iPhoto on my Mac, boom, all my pictures were there. I didn't even have to dock my iPhone. It just happened automatically in the background, and it seems to happen pretty quickly. It works really well. I already kind of mentioned Find My iPhone, although it probably should be renamed, because you can go into the system preferences under iCloud and add your Macs now, and they will show up in Find My iPhone also. All of these services are accessible through the web through iCloud.com if you have a new iCloud account, so you can get access to your mail, your contacts, your calendars, Find My iPhone, Mac, whatever your device may be. That works just fine. It was able to find my devices, all of them, and had no issues whatsoever. Documents in the cloud. This one is the one that I'm probably going to have the most complaints about, or I'm not either enjoying as much, or it's probably an understanding thing, but it does work. It works seamlessly on iOS devices. So once you have documents in the cloud enabled, if you're using the updated versions of the iWork applications, you can create a document on one device and it will automatically sync and show up on another device, another iOS device. So if you have an iPhone and an iPod, or an iPhone and an iPad, that seemed to work great. The problem is, specifically with iWork, Apple didn't update or doesn't have any integration in the desktop versions of the apps. So you need to go to iCloud.com/iWork. There's an iWork icon at iCloud.com when you log into your account. And you have to download the synced documents from the cloud to your desktop to work on them. And then if you change them or update them locally on your desktop, you have to push them back into iCloud.com to get them on your iOS devices. So I don't understand that philosophy at all. It makes no sense to me. And the other thing that still doesn't make sense to me is I don't want to sync all of my documents. If I start an iWork document or a document in an application on my iPad, I'm fine with it syncing up to the cloud, but I don't want it automatically being pushed down to my iPhone. And at least from a visual standpoint, that seems to be what's happening. I'm assuming it's eating up storage space. I'm assuming it's pushing down and actually on the device, because it doesn't seem like when I launch that document from the second device that it's taking any time to download. And maybe they're doing some clever streaming stuff in the background. I'm going to have to dig more into this feature, but I really don't like the idea of everything sort of syncing to my iOS devices. I might be okay with that on my Macs if I had a little extra storage, but it seems like it's not even integrated on the Mac at all. So I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around documents in the cloud. It's not working like Dropbox, and maybe that's my problem. I've been a Dropbox user for such a long time. I really prefer that model where on iOS devices, I can reach back to the cloud storage that I have on Dropbox and pull down the documents that I need to work with and then push them back up into the cloud, and those sync to my Mac. Apple seems to be taking the opposite approach, and I'm not thinking that that's going to be a workflow that works particularly well for me. Maybe other people will use it, and maybe consumers who just want to know that they can work on their documents on their iOS devices offline. It is good for that. I mean, the fact that it gets pushed down to the device means that if you don't have a Wi-Fi connection, your document at least is going to be there to work on. And with something like Dropbox, you can't get the document if you don't have access. But on my iPhone, I have a connection, and on my iPad, I can typically get one. So not so certain about that. The other one that I haven't played around with or enabled yet, although it's getting some good reviews, is backup in the cloud. So you can turn this on in your iOS devices, and you can have them automatically back up your data to the cloud. The reason I didn't do this, and I've since learned that there's some workarounds for this, but when I went to flip it on the first time, it warned me that it was no longer going to back up my iOS data to my Mac through iTunes, that it was only going to go through the cloud and only up to Apple servers. And I was kind of, I was worried about that because I still want to have a local copy of my backup. I don't want my only backup sitting up on Apple servers in the cloud. I've since found out that you can still initiate a manual sync from iTunes to back up your iOS data, and that will create a local copy even when you have iCloud backup turned on. Now, some things to note about the iCloud backup on iOS are that it only does the backup, as near as I can tell from Apple's documentation, only does the backup once a day. They don't really say when, and it will only do it if you have a Wi-Fi internet connection and your device is connected to power. So those two things need to happen. And again, it only happens once a day. So I don't know if there's a way to, again, I think there is a way to manually initiate it and maybe force it to do a backup. But that just seems too out there in terms of when are my backups happening? When is my data going to get backed up and stuff like that? Now, I've heard from people who had their data backed up. Some of the developers who were in the beta program had their iPhone 4 data already backed up when they got their new iPhone 4S, they could use the on-the-device setup, and it would reach out to iCloud and pull down all of their data, including all their app settings, all their folder settings. Everything was completely restored, and they didn't have to do anything. And I think that's the genius of backup in the cloud, and that's going to be a really nice feature, particularly for people that don't have Macs or don't want to deal with Macs. It's going to be cool to be able to go into the store, buy your brand-new iPad 3, flip it on when you're at Starbucks down on the corner with Wi-Fi and have everything sucked in, your device set up right there, not have to run home to your Mac or to iTunes and get that set up. So I see the advantages of it. I'm going to have to probably enable it and play around with it a little bit, but it seems to be working and people are enjoying that feature. So that's iCloud. Now let's talk a little bit about the iPhone 4S. It launched on Friday and it was huge. It was just... wow, 4 million phones, Apple said. I talked about that earlier, and you could tell both, I think, not so much in line. It was interesting. I went down to the Carlsbad store here in San Diego, and I did some line interviews, and I have some data that was collected by one of our listeners, David, at the Knoxville store. I'm going to share that in a separate episode because I think we just have too much to cover in this show. So look for that, those interviews to come out in the next couple days, but... when I went to the line, it was not that large. I got there about 6:30 a.m. on launch day, and there was maybe about 50 people in line at that store. And for the iPhone 4 launch, I think there was about 200 by like about 6 a.m. Now, by the time Apple opened their doors at 8 a.m. Pacific time on Friday, there was maybe 150 to 200 people in line. So it didn't seem like there was that big a demand, at least at the store. And that may have been because Apple did the pre-orders and a lot of people were getting them online. There was no option to pick up in-store, which there had been for, I think, the iPhone 3, 3GS. I forget when Apple stopped doing that. But didn't seem to be that much demand, at least on-site. And it could also be because there were multiple locations you could go to buy. People didn't have to go to an Apple store. You could go to an AT&T store, a Verizon store, I think even Walmart, Best Buy. Multiple places had iPhones on launch day. So that could have been why the reduced crowds. But I had mine delivered. It came via UPS. I think it arrived in the afternoon, right around noon. And I hadn't, because I hadn't been out doing the line interviews. I came back, I had some stuff to do. And then the iPhone 4S showed up and I was excited. I wanted to do my unboxing and that sort of stuff. So I shot photos. If you want to see my unboxing photos, they're up on the MacCast Facebook site at facebook.com/themaccast. Also up there is a link to my YouTube video, the unboxing video that I did. Although that one is kind of funny because both the photos and the videos pretty much look just like the iPhone 4, but if you're into that sort of stuff, you can go check it out. But so I was doing all that, and then I was ready. I wanted to start playing with the device, playing around with some of the new features, and so I went to go set it up, and I hadn't really been watching Twitter or any of the news feeds or stuff like that, and had I been, I would have known that there were major activation issues going on. So I was immediately frustrated because I turned on the device and realized I could do the straight on the device setup and started going through the process, and it was going great. It was setting up, it connected to my network. Perfect, flawless process from Apple. I mean, setting up on the device is really a beautiful thing. If you have an opportunity to play with it, you should. But got to the activation part, and I'm an AT&T customer, and it said it was going to activate. I put in some information. That seemed to be going fine. And then it said, okay, wait 3 minutes, you know, up to 3 minutes while we activate your device. So I sat there waiting and was immediately hit by, oh, sorry, we couldn't activate the device, connected to iTunes or try again. So started the process again, same result, got to the same screen, said it was activating, said it was going to take 3 minutes, didn't activate. I did that 3 or 4 more times. And at that point I was completely frustrated. And that's when I started going online and looking and finding out that everybody was having the issue, including people at the Apple store. It was further exacerbated by the fact that people on Verizon and Sprint were saying, oh, my activation went fine. I had no problem at all. And when you're in the middle of not being able to activate your device, that doesn't typically help. It just serves to get you more and more frustrated. And I was very happy for the people that were able to activate their device. But when you want to play with your new iPhone and you can't, yeah, that's not a fun situation to be in. So what I ended up ultimately doing was calling AT&T's customer service line, and they, of course, were backed up. So I dialed 611 on my other phone, my other iPhone, my iPhone 4, and that was the one, by the way, I wasn't upgrading. I was upgrading my wife's 3GS. So you can't call from the device that you're activating or trying to activate if you want to do an over-the-phone activation. But I called AT&T. Had a long wait to talk to a customer service person. Their customer service people, and this is one of the reasons why I stay with AT&T. A lot of people have asked, why don't you just move over to Verizon? I left Verizon because of their poor customer service. I had a bad experience with them, and I really don't want to go back to them. But the AT&T guy came on. He was extremely helpful. It took him a little while to get through things, and he did warn me that they were having high activations. They were being told that it was interesting. When I called them, they were being told to tell customers it was going to take 10 to 20 minutes to actually activate the device from the time they flipped the switch in their system. By the end of the call, he was being told to advise customers 1 hour to 2 hours. But at that point, I was just happy because I was going to be in line. I was going to be in the queue to get my device activated. And it turned out after I hung up with him that the device was activated within a couple minutes. And that seemed to be the experience of some other users too, that going through calling AT&T, they were able to get it to work. So at that point, I was happy and I was able to play with the device. But it certainly was, they were certainly overloaded. And my biggest point of frustration with that, I think like a lot of AT&T customers, is that they've been through this so many years. It's like every year on launch day, they have trouble with activating devices. And the bottleneck, it seems to be the connection between Apple and AT&T's system. And why they haven't sorted that out by this many iPhone launches, I think is inexcusable. I don't think there's any excuse for that. They should know about this by now. Now, granted, now that we know the numbers, this is about double the activations they did last year. So maybe they didn't think that there could be twice as many activations, but they got to wake up. They got to realize that there's high demand for this stuff and get it sorted out. So hopefully when the iPhone 5 comes out, we don't have another one of these situations again. But my impressions of the iPhone 4S, of course, the number one feature everybody, I think, ran out to test first is Siri. And Siri is amazing. The short review is Siri is amazing, but not perfect. It's absolutely incredible for beta software. And I think it's hard to remember. A lot of people are being very critical of Siri at this point. Apple did say it was in beta, and it's, in my opinion, way beyond beta, but it's beta software. So Apple is going to be working on improving it. They're going to be working on getting it better. It's suffering from some network issues. It's very dependent on the cloud and that network connection. And there's a lot of people wanting to play around with it right now. So I think it's overloaded. I think that's going to die down as people get over the novelty of it and start using it. But I can already see that it's going to be a very useful tool for a number of very specific situations. If you're curious what you can ask Siri, the unofficial Apple weblog has a great list of things that you can say. Also, just on the device itself, there's a little info button. When you activate Siri, you can hit that, and it gives you some basic examples of what you can say. But unofficial Apple web blog did a post with a pretty good list. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. It works great with Bluetooth headsets, although I've been using it in some different environments, and even just on the device itself with background noise, it does a pretty good job. So I don't know if that's because of some of the noise-canceling features that are built into the iPhone, but it seems to recognize most things fairly well. You have to speak clearly and slowly, and it already did come out that some accents, especially not the international ones that it's designed for, but thicker regional accents in different areas can cause some problems. So, you know, it understands UK English or Australian English or American English, but different regions sometimes have thicker accents, like in the United States, the South or Boston. Some of those people are reporting some issues with some recognition stuff. So your results may vary. But if you speak slowly and clearly, it tends to get most things. Some issues that I've encountered, I asked it to tell me the distance to the sun because it has integration with Wolfram Alpha. And it kept wanting to give me directions to Sun City, which I think is near me. So I think it's, a GPS regional thing, because I saw some other things online where people asked that same question and it returned the result just fine. So if you don't have a city with the word sun in its name near you, you might be able to actually get it to do that. It wouldn't tell me directions to the nearest business. So I would ask, you know, give me directions to the nearest Starbucks, and it would come back and say, oh, there's 19 Starbucks near you. Which one do you want? And you actually have to reach up and tap the screen. It'd be nice to be able to just say, oh, well, give me the directions to the nearest one, because that's typically what I think most people are looking for, the nearest version of a place to go to. Tried doing some searches for information on famous people and found out real quickly that if you say who is, it tries to find a person in your contacts. So it searches, you know, the integration with the built-in applications is pretty tight. So it's going to try and find local information connected to the device first rather than doing a web search. So if you want to do a search on Wikipedia or the web, you kind of have to include search the web or search Wikipedia, which is a little less natural in terms of asking questions. It'd be good if maybe it could prompt you after you ask who is, and it gives you the list of people that it thinks it might be in your contacts, if it says, or would you rather have me search the web or search Wikipedia? So those are the types of things that I think as Apple gets through the beta phase, they're going to kind of tweak and improve and stuff like that. Another big downfall, at least initially, is that some of the information is limited to U.S. only. So outside the U.S. right now, I guess you can't get maps, directions, or traffic. Business lookups don't work. The Wolfram Alpha searches are for English-speaking countries only. Apple is saying that they are going to have international improvements, and they should happen this year. So you're not going to have that long of a wait. But if I was in another country like the UK, I'd be a bit frustrated that it doesn't have the maps integration on day one, since it does have support for it. The other big disappointment I had right out of the box was I asked Siri if it could send a tweet, and it came back and said, I'm sorry, I can't send tweets. And with the Twitter integration in iOS 5, I thought it would be very natural, since you can do texting, that it would be able to tweet. Luckily, it's come out that, you know, kind of a workaround you can use, although it would use your SMS plan is Twitter allows you to send SMS messages. So you can set up a contact just called Twitter in your address book and assign the number, the short code for Twitter in your region. And you can get that if you go to twitter.com/devices and log into your account. You can find that information there and enable the ability to send tweets through your SMS messages. If you turn that on, then you can just say, message Twitter, and then dictate a message and have that go out as a tweet through the SMS system. But that is going to count against your SMS messages, so you're going to have to pay that extra SMS fee, which isn't ideal. So hopefully Apple will, again, integrate that stuff. But you can have a lot of fun with Siri. There's some really clever, fun things you can say. Some stuff has been coming up. If you want to change the name, so Siri, by default, will recognize your name in the address book. So if you've assigned, you know, this is me in your address book, then Siri will use your name when addressing you, which is really nice and friendly. If you want her to call you something different, you can say, Siri, I want you to call me. And then whatever you tell her, she will start calling you that from that point forward. So, you know, I have a feeling there's going to be some really interesting things that people have Siri call them. Another little interesting Easter egg, or it's probably a, I don't know if it's a bug or a feature, but if you just say star, like activate Siri and say star, she might come back and say, I don't understand. And instead of saying star, what appears on the screen is an asterisk and you just get a beep. So it's like a tone. And I think that's just related to the touchpad sort of thing. When you do a star, you know, like star 69 and a number or something like that, then you get a beep tone. And I think it plays that back. That's just my theory as to what's going on there. You can say some clever Star Trek references and sci-fi references, and you'll get interesting responses. So one thing a lot of people have tried is beam me up or beam me up, Scotty. And I did that, and she just came back and said, energizing. So there's clever stuff like that. Some of the Wolfram Alpha little Easter eggs are in there. So I asked her to tell me the airspeed of an African swallow, and I got a Monty Python referenced response back from Wolfram Alpha, which I thought was clever. I tweeted that out. So yeah, there's some fun things that you can do with Siri, and a lot of people are playing around and experimenting, but also just incredibly, incredibly useful. All the things that you saw in the video, I've been using it to set up reminders, to send texts, to send emails. It's going to be very helpful in the car for doing certain actions. I was coming back from something and I remembered there was a reminder that I wanted, and I was able to have Siri set that. The whole contextual aspect is really amazing. So, you know, you can say something like, what do I have on my schedule for next week? She will kick back and say, you have 3 items on your schedule next week, and those get displayed on screen. And you can say, oh, my appointment on Wednesday, can you move that to Thursday? And she can do those sorts of actions. Now, that doesn't work everywhere. Unfortunately, she can't update reminders. Looks like she can't update contact information. You still have to do that stuff manually. But still a lot of good built-in functionality with Siri. And about my only other complaint behind it is it does seem to use up battery. I was playing pretty heavily around with the Siri features, and I noticed my battery draining really, really quick. And I have a feeling that's because of all the network activity. And also, it's probably activating the GPS features to do some of the location stuff to figure out directions and what have you. And that just, all of that stuff is always classically sucked down battery. And I was doing the voice stuff with Siri so much, I almost forgot about the voice dictation feature that's built into the iPhone 4S. And that is also really amazing. So if you go into any app where you can enter text on the keyboard, there's now a little microphone icon, and you can tap that, and then you can do speech to text. And I tested it out. It seems like you can record around 30 to 40 seconds. Apple doesn't say up front, but it's pretty much guaranteed that they're using the Nuance technology, Dragon, and Dragon dictation. And it seems even further likely because I tried some of the Dragon dictation commands for doing capitalization and punctuation and stuff like that. And all of those commands worked great. So if you need to add punctuation, you just speak your punctuation. So you say period or quote, end quote, and all of those will be recognized by Siri and translated properly. So that works incredibly well. So voice, big new feature on the iPhone 4S, and I'm really enjoying that. The other thing that I got a chance to try over the weekend, and this just literally blew me away, and it's probably, I'm going to call this the killer feature of the iPhone 4S. If you're wondering, you know, why should you upgrade, the camera could be it. If you take pictures with your phone frequently, and I find myself doing that more and more, the snapshots are amazing. The color is a lot better than the iPhone 4. The crispness of the pictures is better. It is fast. Video looks incredible. The 1080p video looks just amazing. And just the overall speed, both in the time to open up the camera app, to take a photo, especially from the lock screen with the new double tap feature, you can get right into the photo app and start snapping pictures. You can use the physical button, the volume button, to snap that picture. And the shutter speed makes a huge difference in especially getting things like action shots. I was shooting some action shots over the weekend and nothing blurry. I mean, it was just stopping the action right in place and they really looked great. So I am thoroughly impressed with the new camera in the iPhone 4S. Some of the best shots. I mean, it beats definitely my little point and shoots. You know, mine are a few years old, but I think it's going to hold up against a lot of point and shoot cameras. And I don't know how they do it with such a small lens system. It's truly remarkable technology that they've put in there. Of course, the physical design is not changed very much. There are some technical inside design changes. If you look at the exterior of the device, it looks identical to the Verizon version of the iPhone. And that's significant if you're upgrading from an iPhone 4, an AT&T version. You do need to note that the hold switch is moved down a little bit. So if you have an older case that was specifically designed for the AT&T version, may or may not work with the iPhone 4. But the good news is that because the design hasn't changed very much, newer cases and almost any case that was designed to work or accessory that was designed to work with the iPhone 4 on Verizon, that should work right out of the box. It has the A5 processor. It's been determined that it's running slightly slower than the A5 on the iPad 2, 800 megahertz versus 1 gigahertz. The RAM, we were wondering, is it going to be 512 or a gig? Turns out it's 512, just like on the iPad 2. The battery inside, I thought it looked, from some of the early pictures that I saw, the same, but it now looks like it's a little bit wider and there's some extra juice in there, just 0.05 watt hours of extra battery. And then, of course, the dual antenna design that should help with the quote unquote death grip thing, whether or not you believe that exists or not. Also, I just noticed in general, my call quality seems to be better on AT&T. It seems to have better sound. And I don't know if that's attributed to the speaker. I've also read a report that just in general, the volume, specifically the ringer volume on the iPhone 4 is significantly louder than the old device. That does seem to be the case. I'm noticing I can hear it better when it's in my pocket. So just from regular use, that's improved. And that was always a complaint I had with the old iPhone. Sometimes if you had it in your pocket, you couldn't actually hear it ringing. But overall, you know, I love, it's a great design, classic design, so there really probably was no need to update it. Battery life, let's talk about that a little bit, because I didn't notice on day one that I was having real battery issues, but yesterday when I was out and about, it drained the battery, at least in the morning, down to 50% really quick. I had a full charge when I left the house. This is about 8 a.m. By 10 a.m., I was almost at 50%. And that shocked me a little bit. And I had to think back. I was pretty heavily testing and using Siri. Also, I have a lot of notifications turned on and activated. And I also had, for the first time, set up a geofence-enabled reminder. And so I tweeted out about this, and a couple of people came back with some good suggestions and some possible reasons. Many noted that when you get a new device, the lithium-ion batteries need to go through some conditioning. So right out of the box, they're not at their kind of full performance, full capacity. You have to cycle through them a couple times to get that going. I don't know if that's accurate or not. I'm taking people's word for it on that one. Also, George Starcher and a couple other people noted that the geofencing and reminders seems to eat up batteries. So if you've enabled a reminder and turned on the geolocation features, it might be that reminders is pulling the GPS location a little bit too frequently. And anybody who's used a GPS app on any device knows that that GPS sucks battery like you wouldn't believe. And so related to that, there's also some people telling me that if you use OmniFocus, there may be a bug in OmniFocus that turns on the GPS and then doesn't turn it off. I have OmniFocus, but I hadn't really launched it, so I don't think that was what was going on in my case. But just in general, people are noting that battery life might be an issue on the new iPhone 4S, although there's also some reports that people with iPhone 4s, after upgrading to iOS 5, are having some battery issues. I think that could be related just to the new notification system and specifically notifications on the lock screen. Once you have those turned on, you're getting a lot of notifications, which just means a lot of push data coming into the phone, which is going to eat up additional battery, and maybe people just aren't really used to that. But Overall, I am very happy with the iPhone 4S upgrade. I think there's enough significant things in here between the camera and Siri and the A5 processor upgrade. I'm not a huge game player, so graphics, you know, if you're playing a lot of games, that could be significant to you. You know, it's not, it's for sure a, I'm going to call it an extreme incremental upgrade. It's not insignificant like some reviews and reports are making it out to be. Is it a evolutionary jump? Yes. Is it a revolutionary jump? Maybe, depending on what happens with Siri or how important Siri-like features are to you. Definitely a revolutionary jump in terms of the camera, in my opinion. So take that for what it means if you've been kind of holding off on an upgrade. If I wasn't eligible for an upgrade, I don't know that I would pay the upgrade fee, you know, the early upgrade fee for this, or buy an unlocked device. You'd have to have some real specific uses for that. If I was in that situation, I might wait for the iPhone 5 to come out next year when I was eligible to upgrade, or wait until I reached my upgrade period so that I could get the subsidized price. But I don't think anybody who's picking up an iPhone 4S in any way, shape, or form is going to be disappointed in any area other than the battery. And I think that battery issues will kind of get resolved through some software updates and stuff like that. I think it's more just battery management and not necessarily that it has a bad battery or something like that. So that's my kind of early thoughts on the iPhone 4S. I'd love to hear what you think of it, if you're enjoying your device, and if you have any recommendations on battery stuff, let us know. Any little tips and tricks. I've kind of done the normal things when you're turning off Bluetooth and disabling some of my notifications and stuff like that, and I'll let you know if that sort of improves things. And so, as promised at the top of the show, I do have one question from you, and this one comes from Brad. He was having trouble with iTunes and the built-in firewall in Mac OS X Lion. And he wasn't really sure if it was related to the Lion upgrade, but what was happening was almost every time he launched iTunes, the firewall kept asking for approval to allow incoming connections. And every time that would happen, Brad is clicking allow, and that should add it to the listings in the system preference pane in Lion, but for some reason it's not sticking, because inevitably he would launch iTunes again and it would ask the question all over again. So normally, personally, I don't use the firewall. I have a NAT router and I rely on my router for doing kind of my firewall protection. I don't open up ports. I don't allow the universal plug and play, the UPnP options. So I don't let it open up, you know, random ports for me. If I need to, I would go in and enable those manually. So I feel I'm pretty well protected without Apple's built-in firewall. But if you want to use the built-in firewall, it's a great way to go, especially if you don't have a router. Maybe if you're out somewhere using an open Wi-Fi, you probably want to turn the firewall on just to give yourself that extra layer of protection. To do that, you go into the system preferences under security and privacy. And what you should be able to do is just click on the firewall tab, and then you will have to unlock the preference pane with click the little lock icon down at the bottom and enter a username and password to allow changes. And then just click start, and that turns on the firewall. And by default, it should block most traffic and allow some specific things that Apple in the operating system needs. But after that, you should be good to go. Now, if you want a little more finite control, you can click on advanced, and you can adjust the specific settings for specific services. So you can see what Apple adds by default, and you can block those if you don't want those turned on. And then you also have the ability to add individual apps by clicking the little plus symbol and adding an application. But by default, I think iTunes should be in there. If not, you could, of course, add it. And in Brad's case, it should be automatically being added when it pops up and asks you. And that's the other nice thing about Mac OS X is if you launch an app and its services are blocked, it should be able to prompt you and say, hey, can I get access through the firewall? And you can approve or not approve that incoming connection. In playing around with this feature for the first time, because I don't really use it, and I wanted to test out and see if I could replicate what was going on for Brad, I saw some strange behavior. I turned it on, and it popped up a bunch of allow requests for some applications that I use. And I allowed those. I clicked allow because I wanted them to happen. And they were added to the list in the main panel in the system preferences. But after I clicked OK, and when I went back to the firewall, they were suddenly all gone and everything was grayed out and I couldn't really work with the control panel. I was able to at some point come back and click on the little plus icon and add them again. And then the second time that I added those services, they did stick manually. So there may be some strange stuff going on with the firewall in Lion. And then once the programs were in the list, I could set the block incoming connections or allow incoming connections options. And they did seem to stick at that point. I also did try adding iTunes manually and saying allow incoming connections, and it did seem to work just fine. So, Brad, if it's not already in the list, I would check there first, but I think Brad already did. Check there, make sure it's in the list. If not, try adding it manually through the system preference pane. If that doesn't work, I did a bit of searching online, and some users were reporting similar issue, and they said that uninstalling and reinstalling iTunes seemed to fix it. So you just have to go and delete iTunes. I don't know if you have to delete any of the supporting files like system preferences and stuff like that. And I would make sure you do a backup of your music library. It shouldn't be impacted by this, but you know, I'm paranoid about these things. So backup and then try deleting and reinstalling iTunes. Just download a fresh copy from Apple's website and reinstall it. And that seems to fix the issue. I was listening to Dave and John at Mac Geek Gab, and I think they actually addressed Brad's issue. He had sent this out to a couple of us, and they explained why, which was kind of nice. They said that, you know, there's a digital signature. If you look in that firewall setting, so if you go into the security privacy and you look at the firewall setting under advanced, there's a checkbox that says automatically allow signed software to receive incoming connections. So Apple has the ability to give developers the ability to sign, you know, have a valid certificate for their software to say, yes, I am from the vendor I say I am. You should be able to trust me. And there's a whole process that goes through that. Then the operating system and the firewall can trust the application that it's not doing nefarious stuff. That digital signature can, if it's mismatched or corrupt or missing or something else happens to it, that can cause the message to pop up over and over again or to pop up. And that's what it should be doing. It's warning you that, hey, you might not want to trust this software. Something doesn't look right about its signature, about its security certificate. And the weird thing, though, is it shouldn't be happening with Apple software. So at some point, maybe during an update, an iTunes update or something like that, somehow that got mismatched or corrupted, and reinstalling iTunes likely just fixes that signing and make sure that the signing matches up with what the firewall wants to see, and then it won't be bugging you to allow that incoming connection every time. So give that a shot, Brad. That's probably what's going on, and thanks for sending in the question. With that, that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors, Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software and get more information, details at phoronix.com. Circus Ponies, check out Notebook, great application. You can get details, trials, check out those videos from Don McAllister over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, Disk Label, PDF Pen. Remember, you can get 20% off PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro right now, including the family packs, by using the code MACCAST11 at checkout. And you can find more information and details over at smilesoftware.com/MACCAST. And Gazelle, get some cash for that old iPod, that old iPhone, even a digital camera, digital video camera, whatever electronics you have. Just do a simple search over at gazelle.com and turn that old device into cash today. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support of the MacCast. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I want to hear your feedback about all of this stuff. OS X Lion, iOS 5, the new apps, iCloud, new iPhones, new iPod Touches. We didn't even talk about the new white iPhone or the new white iPod Touch. Thoughts on maybe the pending release of an iPad 3. Whatever you want to talk about, I'm happy to hear from you. You can send your emails, your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com or call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9, or on Skype, use the Skype name, the MacCast. And I look forward to hearing from you. You can also check out the show notes, find links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast over at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/themaccast. And that's where I have those unboxing videos and photos if you want to check those out. So thank you to you for hanging out and listening. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.